Salad Show this week, why can't I get my savings right? I'm Christia. With me as always, Simon Brown. How's it going?
It's good. Still award-winning podcast.
Yes, still award-winning. Excellent. I wonder if should that be in the intro from now on, like every week? The award-winning Fat Wallet Show.
Forever. Until you win another award, in which case it becomes
multiple award-winning Fat Wallet Show.
Ching ching.
Yes. Next year, July. If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that we a bleeped version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for making that happen for us. Our listener love index is actually doing a bit better. It's not down 12% anymore. It's only down 8%.
That's called winning.
Yay. I was thinking maybe we should get Zach Besaidenhout in around August. And then instead of doing a new index, we should ask Zach to critique what we did wrong in this index. Like if it were his perfect index, what would he do differently? And then we weighted by Zach.
Instead of by love. Hey, look, love was a great idea, but it turns out love is
But wouldn't it be interesting to know what a person who works with indices all the time
would do when you, when if you they think could about do it, their he was index. Probably sitting there the whole time thinking,
Oh, what a terrible idea. He's so polite, though.
He's far too polite.
But, like, imagine a person who does this, like an expert in this field, if he could do his dream index. Wouldn't you love to know what that is?
Yeah.
I would love to know.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. We have two winners this week, again, because both of them did awesome homework. And I'm really especially excited because both of them are women. So Sally did a lot of legwork to understand an interest payment amount that she saw on a home loan. So she's got a buy-to-let property. And she changed her debit order date on her home loan. And then she noticed that two interest payments went off. Then she got like really freaked out because she was like, okay, why am I paying interest twice? And she sent me a long email about it. And then she did some more investigation. Then she ran her own calculations. And then she got in touch with the home loan provider. And then what she found was, she said, because you changed the debit order date, they work out the interest you owe from the original date until the date you change it. Then they calculate the interest again on the day after your new debit order date. Together, they'll make 1 month's interest. So they don't charge, they charge you twice, but they don't charge you double.
Okay, so it wasn't, okay, so yeah, twice equaling one, not twice equaling two.
Two, yeah.
Okay, yeah, no, cool.
Guys, I just want to apologize for any disgusting things that happened to my body while we record this episode. I've had a cold and it's not great.
You should have started with the cold first part.
Well, you never know. You never know. A lot can happen in an hour.
Fortunately, it's wireless.
Okay, so I think she deserves the win because, first of all, she noticed immediately that she paid interest twice, which means she's keeping an eye on her finances. Attention. She did her own calculations before she contacted the home loan office to see what's going on. She wasn't afraid to ask what was going on from the financial institution. And this is what somebody said to me this week is, why is it that we are so afraid to ask questions about our own money to people who
because
manage
it? Because we get answers that are completely ununderstandable, and that's in part the intent.
Right.
This is an industry that lives on, what's that word? Obfuscation. Is that the word?
Obfuscation.
There we go. That's a better one.
Yes.
Complexity.
And she also deserves to win because she really loves horses. And I like that about her.
Okay.
Then Nadia wrote us. She, in the episode where we spoke about financial crises, I think it was 105, she wasn't sure if she's got the right ETF mix in her tax-free portfolio. So when I responded to that email of hers, I sent her a link to the article on the 6 questions you have to answer before you buy an ETF.
Mm-hmm.
So she did that.
Mm-hmm.
She went to look at all of her ETFs. She read up about every single one that she owns.
Hmm.
She answered each one of those 6 questions. She asked questions. She asked a follow-up question. She wasn't sure what the factor allocation is. And then she's like, cool, I'm happy with the ETFs I hold. And I just think it's very proud that she did her homework on it. And it's like, that's how you're supposed to do it. If you're not sure if you've got the right ETF allocation in your portfolio or the right any sort of stock allocation, you know, go do your homework. And I kind of gave her the tools to do it, and she went out and she just nailed it.
And the point is that if you just say, someone randomly says to you, what's the answer, and you give them the answer, they're not necessarily going to be believing of that answer. You got to do the effort. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Winning.
Yeah. So Sean, this week, inspired our topic because he can't get a handle on his savings. And when I read this email, it was like I was transported back in time because I had exactly the same problem when I started out. He says, my wife and I are going into our 30s and we have no savings other than our Providence and RAs. So already that's a really good thing, as we said.
Yeah, that's a big no.
Yeah. My question is this. We earn a net income of 28,000 Rand. We have 10,000 Rand in debt in total, but we can't afford to save more than 1,000 Rand a month. When we do save, something seems to go wrong and we use that saving to bail us out all the time. So in effect, we have no savings. So I think what he means is there are no discretionary savings. Mm. So because the RA does count as savings. Sure. Don't forget that. Hey?
But for black geezers and...
He says, we never go out or get takeaways. The last time we bought new clothes was 3 years ago, so we look like hobos. Our cars are f***ed and we can't replace them because there's no extra money in the budget. My wife and I don't drink, so there's no wastage there. So the first thing I would say is maybe you should start drinking and then you'll feel better about all of it. I'm only joking. He says, I'm not sure what we're doing wrong. So I love this question because when I was in debt, I had the same issue. I was like, I have this debt that I have to get rid of. And then I try and save on top of the debt. And then the same thing happened to me month after month after month. And then you just get so despondent because you're like, you know, I keep trying to save.
You start drinking.
Yeah. And it just doesn't work. So the first thing I want to say to you, Sean, is the RA is a big deal. Like not a lot of people. We talk a lot about discretionary investments and emergency funds and blah, blah, blah. But the whole point of doing all of that stuff is so that when you can no longer afford to work, that you've got money to look after yourself. This is what we're aiming for, right? Mm. All of us with our savings and discretionary investments and stuff. So if you've got an RA down, you've done a lot already. It's a big deal to have that down.
Particularly at early 30s, because that's a 30-plus year RA, which is significant.
Right, and it means that you can afford to contribute. You don't have to contribute as much to that RA as you would have if you'd started later. Then the second thing I want to say is 1,000 Rand on a 28,000 Rand income is a lot. That's like it's a four and a bit percent saving. Not a lot of people save a few percent over and above their RA contribution.
Yeah, because the RA is already clicking out X percent.
Right.
And that's probably 10, 12, 15.
And I think that this is an important point because we set like these numbers for ourselves because it sounds right. Like it sounds right to save 1,000 Rand a month. You know, it seems like it's not that much money. Sure. And you
can
handle it.
And it makes the 10,000 Rand gone within a year. And that's a nice achievement goal.
Yeah. So the thing is the 10,000 Rand, that actually I should have started with that. I think that Sean and his wife should forget about the savings for now. And just focus on that 10,000 Rand.
Yeah.
Because once you settle that debt, you're going to get used to putting that money towards the debt every month. Once the debt is settled, you're not going to feel that amount going out of your budget every month because you've been doing it for a year, right? So instead of worrying about that 1,000 Rand a month saving, worry about paying off the debt and not using it anymore. So don't take another 1,000 Rand on top of your debt payment out of your budget. Pay the debt and use that 1,000 Rand every month until the debt is paid. Then once you've got that debt paid, you use that debt repayment amount as your savings.
And if you're struggling with the 1,000, make it 500.
Make it 50.
Which I know stretches the date out. But to your point is that if you become despondent, then you know, this is your – it's not that you only have one chance, but the truth is that it's easy easiest the first time. Because if you fail, going back is takes a lot more courage. The first time you go and you're ignorant, you don't know anything. So maybe it takes you 2 years. Maybe it takes you 3 years. I mean, that's fine. You're in your 30s. Time is on your side.
Yeah.
And the point is that achieving the goal is more important than the time frame. I mean, you know, doing it by Tuesday would be bestest, but not going to happen. So, you know.
Yeah. So, and the thing is also, if you guys are living this way, like you're not getting takeaways, you can't afford to buy new clothes, you're going to get to a point where you're going to go, or maybe you won't, but I would have gotten to a point where I would have gone, f*** pocket.
I would have gone and robbed a bank.
Yeah, I can't get ahead anyway. I might as well go deeper into debt because you get so... it's hard to live this way. Yeah. It's not easy to go, oh, sorry, we can't go out with you, or, oh, I can't afford this thing that I really want.
Or worse, and we've talked about this before, I don't know if online or offline, but where your solution then becomes, I will win the lotto one day, or I will get a giant bonus, or and all of those things are... not impossible, but truthfully, not a strategy and not likely.
So a while back, I wrote for one of our newsletters a thing about perfection and how we know, and this is what Sean gets. Like, Sean understands he has to keep his lifestyle costs low, which he's getting right. He understands that he has to provide for his future. He's already getting that right. He understands that the debt needs to be paid. He's getting that right. Mm. He understands that he needs to save. So he's already getting that right, right? So Sean, you're doing actually incredible. I know it doesn't feel like it, but you're doing incredibly well already because you do understand what you need to be doing. The problem comes in when
we're trying to do it.
Right. Yeah. The problem comes in when we strive for perfection because you want to get everything right all the time. And this is something that I keep saying in this podcast. Like, good financial decisions is about making a good decision more often than a bad decision. It's not about making the right decision every single time. So if you can pay off this debt, use that 1,000 rand that you've been putting away to save, because obviously you can't afford to save it. If you have to delve into your savings all the time, you cannot afford your savings.
Yeah.
This is why we also tell people never to start investing if you don't have an emergency fund.
Yeah.
Because you get into this situation that Sean is in right now, where you actually can't, you have to keep going into that investment and taking money from the investment to fund your day-to-day living. So forget about the ideal picture, Sean. You're doing well enough as it is. Get rid of the debt. Use the 1,000 rand every month. Don't stress yourself out over it. If you feel like you really, 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 really want to get ahead of your savings, save 1% of your income in a month. And slowly over time, as your debt becomes less, you can add to that 1%. But start rather with a smaller amount. And this is... it's savings month this month, and Easy Equities asked us on Twitter, what are your savings hacks? And I think they were looking for, like, you know, turn off your geyser and that sort of thing. But
brush your teeth on Wednesday.
The point I made is, if you can't get into the habit of saving, the amount of lifestyle cost reduction is not going to help you at all. So if you start, Sean, with 50 rand a month, and that's all you can afford, that's enough. You don't need to save 1,000 rand a month. Start with 100 bucks, start with 50 bucks, even if you really want to tick every single box.
Yeah, because it's the discipline you learn, it's the process you learn. And that was my reply to Easy Equities as well, was just save. It doesn't matter the amount, it's the discipline that's important, and getting into it. And the amount will sort itself out in time, but that first process is learning that discipline and getting into that habit of doing it.
Right. And Sean, you guys are young.
Yeah, very young.
Your income is going to increase over time. You're going to pay off this debt and you're going to get into that habit of taking care of your finances first. Oh, this is the other thing. Sam Beck-Bessinger in her book talks about the savings ratio. And what I love about that ratio is that it's not just the amount that you are saving in cash or putting towards investments. She also counts the debt repayment. So any sort of positive financial action that you're taking towards your future, whether that's a debt repayment, an RA contribution, which you should count, Sean, cash savings or discretionary investments, all of that goes into that ratio. So you count, you add everything up that you're saving or paying towards debt. You divide that by your after-tax income, and that gives you your savings ratio. And your mission is over time to increase that ratio as much as you can. And so use that as a rule of thumb. But give yourself a little bit of a break here, Sean. Like, I think you're being a bit too hard on yourself with that 1,000 rand a month. I think it's a bit of a stretch at this point. Wait until your debt is paid off, and then aim for the 1,000.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Cool. Cool.
Cool. That was a nice short one. And that's great because we've got a lot of feedback. In the episode on preparing for a financial crisis, we spoke about Sanlam dangling a carrot for Wim. Do you remember with the Echo bonus?
Yeah.
So Brett wrote in to explain how that actually works. He says,
"Pay attention, Tom.
I started an RA with Sanlam at age 22, which was based on their Echo bonus feature. It means all the contributions that I made to the RA during its life would be tallied up and given to me at retirement on top of my investment returns and original contributions.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So we've spoken about this before.
I mean, so OUTsurance do a similar thing with their product. I think it's their life product, where if you don't claim, so actually it's a life product, so if you don't die and until it's expiry or something, they give you your contributions back.
That seems so unfair. Let's not think you can help that.
not dying is called winning. But what they're doing, I mean, the catch is quite simple, really, because what they've effectively done is they're just giving you back the contribution. Now, he put a contribution when he was 22, call it $100. When he's 65, they give him $100. I mean, when he's 65, which is 43 years' time, $100 is worth approximately nothing. So, sweet. I mean, gimmicky.
Right.
Truthfully, and I mean, just gimmicky.
So he says, this bonus sounded great, but of course the fund had fees of 3.5% per year, and I'm sure you know how the rest would go. He wrote an article about it on his blog. I'm going to put the link in the show notes for you guys to go see what he wrote. He said he didn't name the fund in the article, but that is the fund that he's talking about. So he actually ran the numbers, and he found out that over time, the fees actually completely obliterate that.
Yeah, the 3.5% fee
is wild.
Is wild. It's wild.
So Sally, who won this week, also wrote about the eco bonus. She says she currently has that RA as well as a 10X1 because she didn't have enough invested in the Sanlam one to qualify for the transfer. And I didn't know that. I didn't know there was like a minimum amount before you could transfer. She says, if I assume the rate of growth and contribution from my side to just compare fees between the two, you pay obviously less at 10x and the fees are at Sanlam are more over the entire term. However, because of the eco bonus, the end amount I got from the Sanlam RA was similar to the 10x one with the reduced fee. So that was my situation specifically, because the eco bonus works on how long you're invested. And so the longer you are with them, the higher percentage of the bonus you get. You miss out on the compounding over time, but at the end of the day, it was much of a muchness for me. I decided to leave the two just as they were, so now I have two RAs.
Yeah.
It's fair enough.
Yeah, run the math, see how it works. But the thing is that they dangle carrots, which are nice, but not necessarily significant, and then, and the scammers... 3.5%.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, someone's definitely getting rich there, and it might not be you.
Very unlikely to be you. Sepatisile found a company. I spoke about this last week, except I said her name is Sefatsile, and she's like, dude, no, that's just not right. And so she sent me an email. Sepatisile.
Sepatisile.
Sorry about that. Man, so at the Comrades, you get... When you get a bib, your name is written on it. Your first name is written on your race number. And the first time I went to watch the Comrades, there was a lady in front of me, and she was like cheering people on, come on, John, come on this, come on that. And I was like, how does this woman know so many runners? It's insane. And then it took me a while to figure it out. And I was like, okay, the name is on there. So this year I go to spectate again. And the runners come past, and I really like it. Really is like a moral boost for them when you call them by their name. But then sometimes somebody would run past me and they would have like a 13 letter name.
It's like, sorry.
And I would can't. Really, really want to like be encouraging, but it's like, sorry, this
hey,
is
hey, you with blame, the big name.
Yeah, blame your mother for this. Yeah, I can't.
Five letters,
you.
Two syllables.
Like, I noticed that the Comrades at 7 was my upper limit mine, for a running person.
Mine might be 6, probably 5 in truth.
So she says, last week I came across Capital Legacy. We spoke about this last week as well.
They
offer free wills, and they promise to finalize your estate matters in 6 to 8 months with the option to pay your fees in advance as monthly contributions so that your family don't worry about it. So the estate duty, essentially, you pay up front.
The estate duty or the... Okay, the estate duty or tax. So tax not. The
no,
tax
no,
is separate.
Yeah, yeah.
The,
so
the cost that they're going to charge for doing that wrap-up in 6 to 8 months.
So they do a payout to the family within 48 hours so that life can carry on while they sort out your estate matters. So I checked them out. They seem legit. And then I asked on Twitter, and a whole bunch of advisors and CFAs said that they use them. They really like the business. Somebody said that they basically just use a combination of life insurance. It's like a because that's how they get to pay out within 48 hours. So they do a will for you, and then they have a small life insurance policy that pays out to your family right away. But go check them out. It's like, so they seem like a legit company. Lots of people seem to really... Yeah, like
that's cool. What I like about it is Will's is someone who specializes in that process. You know, I mean, it's something we only need once in a life, and it. I mean, I've had a few estates done, both my parents, grandparents, etc. And the people who did them were always a bit random. And yeah, they did them, and they did them in about the 6 to 8 months. But that's because they were really, really simple estates. But they, I always felt that perhaps they could have been more, get pros.
Right. Yeah. So there's a company that got in touch with us the other day. They're called Zakfin. It's Zakfin. And we were speaking to these people, and they are wanting to do kind of a robo will that allows you to kind of put together your own will online. So I don't know how long it's going to take them to get that up and running, but I know that it's something that they have in the pipeline. So go check out. It's zakfin.com.
.com. There are other, I know some other people who are doing robo-wills of sorts. And they work if it's, I suppose it's level of complexity, but they ask you some questions, plug the information in, et cetera, and that sort of thing. And if you don't have an executor, they'll executor it for you. Truthfully, in the olden days, just go to CNA. I mean, it depends the complexity of your estate. Yeah, if your estate is just, you know, cash and assets and stuff like that, and you're just leaving it to a kids or a spouse or something like that, then a will really is a simple process. If you've got trusts and, you know, that, and you want to create things, and then it gets complicated.
All right. So somebody, one of the advisors that I spoke to, said they don't use Capital Legacy. They decided to bring all of that estate planning in-house because it does get complicated sometimes. But you know what? Because she was saying that she's just graduated, she's starting on her journey, whatever, you can probably get away with something like that. Yeah,
for sure.
Gerard is not loving property right now. He's had some bad experiences. He says, I've managed to make some bad property investment decisions in my life of the buy to let variety. Then I thought, let me try this listed property thing, and supposedly it beats buy to let over the long term. And he knows about Magnus's presentation that we have on justonelap.com. You can go search for buy to let.
Buy to let DeVette, Magnus DeVette.
Magnus DeVette.
Search for him, yeah.
He says, I'm uncertain if his calculations still hold. For you guys who don't know, the property market has basically taken a nosedive in an epic way this year. The last time I checked, the three big property ETFs were all down 25%. So it's like this year has not been kind to property. As you can see below, so he sent me a little screenshot, is the graph of the PropTrax 10. And I'm no technical analyst, but this is not looking proper. This is not looking pretty. And it's basically just like a graph and then a straight line down. It was terrible. Shame. I'm sorry to laugh.
So, I'm looking at not the PropTrax 10, so the index itself, which peaked in late 17, in fact, peaked, peaked pretty much in 29 December last year at, let's call it 74, and is now at 54. That's very ugly.
It's not pretty at all. He says, I would love you if you could comment on what in the world is going on with it. Is it okay if I still hold it? I really don't want to climb out of it now as I'm far underwater. So that's a good call. Don't climb out when you're under. Remember, you only make a profit or loss when you sell.
Yeah. And so there's also the equal weight, which peaked at 23 and is down at 17, which is, for once in its life, equal weight doing what it's meant to do. So what happened in the property, and it's technical, but resilient. Green Bay, Fortress A and Fortress B, which are all, and Nepi Rock Castle, which, although they're five separate companies, are deeply interlinked by all sorts of complex and et cetera ways. When the viceroys came out, there was concerns that there was bad stuff happening there. We had reports.
What kind of bad stuff?
Well, so the cross holdings are of concern that they had been propping up their shares using trusts.
Do those companies all hold shares in each other?
Yeah, there's lots of cross holdings, accusations, particularly particularly at the resilient level, that they were using their BEE share scheme and some groundsman at some Kalani school and Mr. Oberholzer and this and that and propping up share prices, etc.
Do you realize that you're just saying like a whole bunch of words now? You're not actually telling me a story.
No, so what I'm trying to say to you is that this is amazingly complicated. And Resilient was trading in December at the princely sum of over 150 and is now 55. So what happened is because Resilient had done so incredibly well, it had run hard, it had become a giant big stock in the index, and then the wheels came off. And whether these wheels coming off are justified or not is irrelevant. The price is down 60-odd% in the time. FFA, FFB, Green Bay and Nepi are better, but not by a heck of a lot. And because of their weightings in the index, they've killed those indices. So two things. Firstly, the equal weight has done better because it caps at you know, they could only be 10% because there's 10 stocks in it, whereas in the SAPI, which is the property index, the big guys get up to 18, 20, 24% of that index. So a lot more pain in the market cap weighted index as opposed to the equal weight. Excuse me, do you sell? No, because the story behind property remains the same. The fact that a couple of property stocks have had their wheels come off, and I don't know what their future is. I don't know if they survive or not. I mean, no reason why not, but you know, whatever happens there is that the index is doing what it did, right? There was a stock that got big, it collapsed, the index is hurt. Property in of itself remains what property is, right? Which is a physical asset. You buy it at these days a premium to the underlying value of the asset, and it pays a decent yield to you.
Right. Gerard, maybe you also want to just start looking at some equity holding there.
But I hold PropTrax 10. I've held it forever and a day.
So do I.
I think since IPO, in fact, if memory serves, it was Fortress, and now it's a core shares product, and I continue to hold it.
It's interesting to me that there are so few property companies. Like significant property companies.
Sure. If we go back to the listing of the PropTrax, not the 10, the PropTrax SAPI, South African Property Yielding Index, that's got 20 stocks in it. When that was listed, there were only 18 stocks that qualified. There were only about 24 property stocks on our market. And there's a reason behind it. We used to have property loan stocks, property unit trusts. They were unique to South Africa. They were weird beasts. We then converted to the REIT structure, which is a globally acceptable structure. So, because Americans would look at our puts and PLSs and say, like, what the f*** are these? Like, have you guys not? So when we converted to REITs, we became more globally friendly and understandable, and we have seen an explosion in listing of property stocks. But most of them, with a few exceptions, like Hammerson is listed locally and stuff, most of them have listed sort of at the bottom end of the market, the smaller caps, some niche ones as well. We've got the storage and stuff like that, but they mostly come down at the bottom end. So we've got a much bigger number of property stocks, but a lot of them in the small cap space.
Can you just explain what a REIT is?
A real estate investment trust. So it's the legal structure of how they do it. So pretty much our PLSs and our property unit trusts, and although they were property unit trusts, they traded on the JSE, but they had the unit trust structure. They were fairly similar, but what a REIT does is it has a ManCo, which is a management company who gets a fee for managing the properties and the debt and everything else, and then any profits that are made are set percentage as a minimum, and I think it's 75, has to be paid out to investors.
Okay. Gerard, I hope that answers your question.
Don't stress, don't sell. I mean, it looks ugly, but truthfully, it's just 7 months of ugly.
So sticking to the property theme, Pomelo is about to become a property owner, and they want to know, they've got three questions. I'm in the process, I think all three of these are great questions, by the way. I'm in the process of getting a bond. I was wondering which is the best option. How's this for a question? Do I get a 30-year bond and pay it off as quickly as possible? Or do I get a 20-year bond and pay just the required installment?
Why don't you get a 20-year bond and pay it off as quickly as possible?
Well, what if you get a 30-year bond and you make it an access bond and you use it for your emergency fund and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, sure. The first point is never plan to pay a property off over 20 years. That's just really, really silly. You should be able to get it down without too much stress. A few easy tricks, you should get it down to 7 to 10 years.
So what is the – how can you think about what property you can afford in relation to your salary?
Ah, it's a good point. So I think the bank is happy that your income, and if they
yeah,
will
but
take
the bank is no, I mean no, the bank
but
is going to
start
shock
at
you.
That point. I mean the bank, and they'll take your spousal income, so both of you. They will they're happy with a bond payment of around 30% of your income. Which is, for those who can't see right now because it's an audio podcast, Chris's head just fell off her head. which is somewhere approximating insane. I frankly think that you should go and figure on a payment of around maybe 10 or 15% of your income into a property. And then what you do, if the bank says, okay, we'll lend you R1 million on your income, which would require about 100,000 joint salary, between 70 and 100,000 if you want to do 10 or 15. If the bank says we'll lend you R1 million, then go and buy a house for 800,000, but pay it off as if it was R1 million. Mm. In other words, you pay in advance. And then every year when you get a salary increase of 6%, the amount of money that you pay, you increase by 6%. Move pay date from the first of the month to payday. When I worked at Standard Bank, payday was the 20th, so I was paying 11 days early. That's
so this
what,
is what Sally did.
What Sally did. Mm.
It's weird because in a home loan, it works so much because it's such a huge amount. Mm. Like a few days of interest payment actually
so
makes a big difference.
I ran
difference.
The math once, and I think I moved it from paying it on the 1st to paying it on the 28th, which is 3 days. And that shaved 4.5 months off your duration. Now, 4.5 months is – no, I mean 4.5 months. If you're paying R10,000, that's R45,000. That's like holiday.
Yeah.
Like you could buy half of Durban.
Mm. So I just checked because I've got I just opened my budget. My rent is 13%.
Yeah, that, to my mind, that's about
of you know, my income.
And here's the trick, and we've probably you know, the issue is quite simple, right? So we can go and buy the fancy 7-bedroom house with a fountain and a circular driveway and a wine cellar and blah 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 and everything else, etc.
The butler comes.
No, butler's extra. No, well, I think I'm pretty sure butler's extra, but a helipad could perhaps be included. What the I mean, you just, with respect, unless you're the Queen or the President, no, not the President, unless you're the Queen, you're just being stupid. You know, cut your cloth according to. So, you know, living in a small 2-bedroom apartment, is that like the end of the world? No. Is it as comfortable as having a butler and a helipad? No. But you know what? When you're 65 years old, you're going to have money. Otherwise, when you're 65 years old, you're going to have a helipad, but you won't have a helicopter, so what?
Yeah, so and you won't be able to eat.
So what we typically do is we go, the bank says we'll lend you R1 million, so we look at houses for R1 million, and then we actually buy a house for R1.2 million. So we,
because of the transfer costs and all of that.
Oh,
well,
no, just because our eyes get big. You know, it's like when you go into the candy store and you're only going to buy one chocolate, but you walk out with 12. Or is that just me?
No, it happens.
That happens. And I'm always saying, you know what, and look, partly because I've just been through this exercise, but by downscaling from a large multi-bedroom house to a small 1-bedroom flat, my cost of my house is 85% down. I mean, the impact on my cash flow every month is insane.
So the other thing that you have to think about when you get a home loan is, now I see some calculators actually included, but the cost of transfer of a house can be very, very big. And we underestimate it because you're like, cool, I get $1 million from the bank. I'm going to buy a house for $1 million. And then you don't take into account the, what, 50,000 odd rand that it costs to transfer from one.
So it's not that onerous because your first, so there's a tax you pay, and your first, I think it's 900,000 is free. So if you can buy a property under 900,000, and you can, and in Joburg you absolutely can, and you can buy 3-bedroom apartments from Baldwin for 1.1, 1.2, under 900,000 you don't pay transfer, and that's a biggie. That's a massive biggie. So when I bought my apartment, it was like the whole cost was like R40,000. Of it, the chunk was actually the lawyer. Probably 30,000 was the lawyer, and then some tax for the transfer part of it. But the person who bought my house, and it was 50%, yeah, it was more than the apartment, etc. But his total cost was closer to 110,000 because he had a bond, and there's a fee for the bond, whatever that might be, the lawyery person, the tax that he had to pay, transfer tax, etc. And it got really, really chunky.
Yeah. So if you get a home loan, make sure that you leave a little bit of wriggle room. Take the whole amount, but leave a little bit of wriggle room in the price of the house that you get.
Yeah.
So that you can afford all of those duties and stuff. Like, imagine you bought a house for R1 million, you took a loan for R1 million, and you have to pay over and above that still R100,000 to settle the legal
even
stuff
if it's,
around
even
it.
If it's 40, I mean, and that's just it. So back in the day, the banks used to do 110% bonds or 105-110% bonds to cover you for that money. Now they're doing 90% if they really, really like you. But you're still, so you've got to put your deposit down, which is 100K. You're going to need, on a million rand house, you're going to need it probably another 50 at a base minimum. And you haven't got curtains yet, hey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the cost of the move as well is not insignificant. You should know this because you also, like both of us, very recently moved. Yeah. And it's not a cheap thing to move into a new place.
It's not a cheap thing. And it's not just the bucky. And yes, you might have a friend and you can rope them in, you know, under threat of, I don't know, exposure to move your stuff. But it's like, you know, City Power wants a deposit. There's this, there's that. Your curtains. I mean, there's all that sort of small little random things that individually are a couple of thousand rand, but it ends up being a large amount of cash. Mm.
Pamelo doesn't have life cover. I'd like to find out, how does one go about getting life cover for the bond? Do I need to go through the hassle of meeting five different brokers and comparing which one is better?
So it's a legal requirement. You won't get a bond without life cover because, you know, banks are banks. Mm-hmm. The banks will obviously offer you their own life cover, which may or may not be. You don't need to meet peeps. You can just make some phone calls. In fact, you can just do some Googling and go to a couple of... So when I got it, I had a bond through Standard Bank when I got the previous place in 2007. Bond through Standard Bank, I went to three or four websites, got quotes. The Standard Bank life quote was horrendous, even as a staff member, and I went with one of them and got a different life policy.
So you're not obligated to go with your bank?
You're not obligated, but you're obligated to have life, but not with the bank. Okay. And so what happens is you go onto these websites and they won't give you the quote until you give them contact details. So you've got two choices, fake contact details, like websites have never heard of this. Or if you give them the contact details, they will harass you until you block them on your phone. Mm. But that's easy enough.
Right. And then the last question from Pamelo, unrelated to home loans. I wanted to say, before we move on from the home loans, let's say you take a million rand bond and it's a stretch for you to pay that bond repayment every month, whether it's over 20 years or 30 years, remember that you still need to pay tax on your property most of the time.
Yeah, right.
You need to pay
insurance.
Insurance. You need
on
to pay
the property and your life.
You need to pay your water and electricity every month. So that's another reason not to go for the full amount that you can get, because after your home loan repayment, you still have to pay over and above stuff. So that's kind of how they got me with this property. They're like, I got into this apartment I rent, but I got into this apartment because the rent is really good for the neighborhood. And then they're like, oh, just by the way, you have to pay rates and taxes over above that. And your electricity, obviously, like I knew about the electricity, but, you know, and it pushed my rent a lot higher than I thought it would
be. The thing is, as well, is if you've taken a million rand bond and you're struggling and you can just meet it, what happens when interest rates go up 3, 4, 5, 6%? And this has happened. So in 08, our interest rates went up about 7%. In 1998, interest rates went up about 14%.
Don't you have the option of choosing a fixed interest rate?
So you can do fixed. What they will typically do is fix at a slightly higher rate. So if they would offer you 10% on a floating rate, they'll offer you maybe 12 at a fixed. But that fixed is typically only fixed for a 2, 3, maybe a 4, but it's only fixed for a couple of years.
Really?
It is not fixed for 20
Ooh, that's
years.
That's sneaky.
Ain't no bank fixing for 20 years because that could cost them money.
Yeah.
So because the world that we live in, you know, it's Africa and planet Earth. In America, the equivalent of the prime rate, which is the Fed rate, has gone from 0.25 to 2. That's an 8-fold increase. Now, home loans haven't gone up, you know, 8-fold, but they've certainly probably gone up 20, 30, 40%. Truth answer, so yeah, can you afford it? And so if you're doing it on the edge, what happens when that edge suddenly crumbles? Can you still make it work? And that's why when interest rates rise, property prices collapse, because a lot of people are right on the edge, they can't afford it, they default, and suddenly houses flood onto the market.
Did you once say that you don't pay VAT on electricity?
I have no idea. Did I once say that?
Because I pay VAT on electricity. I've been trying to figure out my prepaid electricity for months since I moved in here. Like, I moved in here in November. And I've been trying to get it, because what I really want to do, just for the sake of my own sanity, is buy 500 units at the beginning of the month, because that is the allowance that they give you. After 500 units, you pay more per unit. But I never hit the 500 mark, and I couldn't figure it out. Then I was like, okay, wait, VAT. And then I added the VAT, and then I tried to figure it out again, and I still don't get to the 500 units. I got to 440. This is the closest I've ever gotten.
So I'm looking at a statement from COJ, but I don't know what this is a statement for, because it seems complicated. But there's a VAT amount on it, so there's definitely VAT, but they don't actually tell me what this is
so
for. Here it is.
This is the point that I was trying to make. Interest rates going up, that's a big thing. Electricity prices going up, if you're right on the edge, that's a big thing. And this VAT increase has had a huge impact. It's clapped me big time in my electricity expenditure. And you think, oh, 1%, what big difference can that make? But it makes a big difference.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, okay, that was a rates bill. So you do pay VAT on rates. Here is a electricity bill.
So I checked for my prepaid, and I checked where I buy the prepaid, and there's actually a stated VAT amount there.
Yeah, so this statement is actually illegal because it doesn't separate VAT out. So it turns out that my management people are just cheating me anyway. I have no idea.
They
don't mention VAT at all. That is so totally illegal.
So last question from Pamelo.
Yes.
I would like to get an ETF that pays dividends. However, I would like to have the dividend payout invested in a tax-free savings account. Is it possible, and with which financial provider?
So if the ETF is not sitting in a tax-free account, it will pay dividends into your normal account, and you will then have to yourself transfer that money in to your tax-free account. If it sits within a tax-free account, then of course it is will be paid into the tax-free account. So that's cool and good. The trick is, and we've been down this road before, and in fact, I think you've done a blog on it, there's not very many high-yielding ETFs. In fact, I was chatting with CoreShares just last week, and even the property ETFs are not massively high-yielding. So the high-yielding one is the prefix, which is preference shares, which in time will disappear, perhaps, because certainly banks are no longer being rewarded for holding for the preference shares are no longer being credited.
What reward did they get? I remember you saying this to me once.
It was considered to be tier one capital, and it's no longer. So tier one is just a high level, and they hold that, they can lend out X, and it is no longer. So they basically are unwinding it. Capitec doing it fairly aggressively. The other folks
unwinding fairly aggressively?
Well, buying back their ETFs.
Okay.
Preference shares.
So preference share, for those of you who don't know, is like a bond, but for a business.
Yeah, so it's a debt instrument. You've basically lent money. So the prefix itself, okay, sitting on about a 11% dividend yield.
Yeah.
That's
so if
bad.
You guys go to justonelab.com/ETFs, so ETFS, you're going to see I did a dividend investing for dividends series. Like the one was about equity ETFs and the others were about property ETFs. Just as an aside, as a result of writing that article, I found out the dividend payments that you get from a property ETF goes towards your income tax. You don't pay a dividend withholding tax on that. You pay income tax. In other words, if your income tax is higher than 20%, you're going to pay more more tax on dividends that you get from property than that you get from equity. And then somebody explained it so nicely. They were like, if you had a buy-to-let apartment, that income would go into your income tax. So this just is treated the same way.
So prefix, what's the fun part about prefix is it pays dividends. So it doesn't pay interest or anything like that. It actually pays dividends, which back in the day was really attractive because the dividend tax rate was 10%. It's now 20%. But again, depending on your tax rates, et cetera, et cetera. The thing with prefix is two things. Firstly, you can have capital loss. And in fact, this has been as high as 916 in July of last year and as low as 765 in February. So you can have capital loss. You can have capital gain. In theory, you should have neither. You should not get any capital appreciation or depreciation. All you get from this is a nice chunky yield, and that yield is linked to prime. So as prime goes up, so all of these preference shares pay a percentage of prime. So they'll say we pay 80% of the prime rate. So if prime's 10, they'll pay 8. Some pay 60%. Some pay 110%. So as prime is rising, they will pay a larger cash amount every interest payment. And as prime is falling, they will pay a smaller amount every period. What's also nice, but perhaps moot, is it pays quarterly dividends. So you get a cash flow every 3 months.
Mm. Okay. Cyrus, which is a pseudonym, and I love this because this person's like, I want to use it, I want you to use a pseudonym, but use this one.
Okay. So that that did not come from your pseudonym generator.
No. They had to help a family member deal with debt. And the process is frustrating to say the least. I have a lot of empathy for this situation. They say, this is the second time you mention in terms of, you mentioned supporting family. Today's mention to the previous podcast was about paying off their debt with a low interest arrangement. Previously, it was about supporting them if they're in the dwang. Mm-hmm. So we tried that, the supportive role. My sibling was at rock bottom. They maxed out their credit card clothing account and they had less than 500 Rand in their check account. I went to town on their budget and came out with a stop-start-continue plan. Part of it was to financially support their essentials. I didn't want to pay off their debt since I wanted them to, the sibling and their spouse, to learn how to handle cash. Things went south pretty quickly as I continually pushed frugality and it was not being met with my expectations. This is the problem when you give other people money. Is like there's an expectation that they will spend that money the way that you would spend it, and they never do. Yeah,
or that you want them to spend it, and they never do.
They never do. And like I have this dilemma now. Like I have a friend that I really want to help out, but I know if I give her money and she spends it on something that I wouldn't have spent it on, it would be hard on our friendship.
See, now my lovely wife, I gave her money to buy me whiskey. And what did she buy? Groceries. What world? Like, groceries, beans and stuff.
So Cyrus says they weren't keen on only eating peanut butter. I had a 10-point plan and they were already challenging it at point one. The short of it is that another family member has bailed them out with a low interest agreement, but I've stopped my involvement due to my anxiety and friction it created. Family, ugh.
No, look, I hear. And you know, so then the question is, and this is a philosophical and the answer is going to be different for different people, is are you beholden to helping your family? Or are you prepared to say, I'm prepared to help within certain parameters, and if you won't meet me halfway at least with those certain parameters, like if you've got a 10-point plan, at least get to point five. And if you're not prepared to come to the party, are you prepared to cut them adrift? Now, some people will say, oh, no, family, blood thicker than water. I'm a cold-hearted. I'm like, sorry, sorry.
You know, it drives me.
You've got to come to the party.
It drives me crazy because I'm not at this point yet, but I can see this coming every day. This comes closer to me. And I know in the end, I'm going to be the person who is responsible and who's going to have to help out. And it's going to hurt me financially and it's going to hurt my future and it's going to hurt my plans. And because I know in the future I'm going to be responsible, the decisions that these people make with their money, like, affect me. It causes me so much anxiety, and it's anxiety that it's not causing them, and I'm not even giving them money yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no.
See, I'm also fortunate. I just have one single sister and a wife who buys groceries instead of whiskey. That's my wife. And my sister's very responsible, and, you know, her car's dying. And I'm like, well, what are you going to do? She's like, no, I've been saving for a new car for the last 5 years. It's like, oh.
Oh, good. Oh,
okay, so it's dying 8 months early. It's like, that's fine. She's got money in the bond. She'll take that out, buy the car, and then, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, but there's other parts of the family who I just have nothing to do with, because as much as I've tried to say, you know, let's put process in place, they've all been like, no, just send money. I'm like, not a f-.
And that's the point. It's like, I wouldn't mind if my family said to me, hey, can you help me out with dealing with my financial situation? Right. And we all sat down and we all came up with a plan. I wouldn't mind helping, but that's not what they're doing. Like, it's always like, okay, this is not a problem. This is not a problem. This is not a problem. And I can see that it is obviously a problem. Luckily for me, I have a sibling who hopefully would also be able to help out when the time comes, you know. But yeah, it's not, Cyrus, I'm sorry that you're in this situation. It's frustrating. Stefan has some great insights into the Easy Equities offshore account. He answered that question for us. And he also shared an idea with the TFSA for kids thing, which is a question that we get a lot. My son is 2.5 years old. My goodness, this child is cute. I follow Stefan on Instagram, and he's got this like little boy with this giant head of, a head of giant curly hair. The child is a normal sized head.
Yes.
Super cute.
He's also like 2.5. It's like insane. Because when we met Stefan, he was like footloose and fancy free.
Well, when I met him, he was just about to have a baby.
Okay.
But it's the cutest little boy. Anyway, irrelevant to this conversation. Even non-cute kids can benefit from this conversation. After he was born, I opened his own Easy Equities account. We got a question from Jennifer this week to asking the same kind of thing. He says, as you already know, doing so gives you access to three accounts. So opening an Easy Equities account gives you access to a tax-free savings account, a regular Easy Equities account, and a US dollar account, so an offshore account. He says, every month I add to his savings, but I split between the tax-free savings account and the regular Easy Equities account. So either half-half, or in 1 month I do TFSA and then the other month regular, depending on
so when the kid's doing. 18, he'll have a pile of cash in the non-tax-free for sex, drugs, rock and roll, and the rest he can roll through to...
In his tax-free, which is great, because even if you don't get to that tax-free limit every year, that 33,000 rand, it means that your kid then can carry on when he starts
there
working.
There will be some money in there that at the age of 60 will be like 60 years old.
Yeah.
And even if it was a small amount, man, 60 years is a long time,
right. He says, my thoughts here are that if need be, the funds from the regular account can be drawn for things like an education and a car at about 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there are funds can be drawn means that we don't have to tap into his... The fact that there are funds that can be drawn means we don't have to tap into his TFSA, and we can let that run until he retires rich one day. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. He says, I know there will be a tax hit on the regular account, so perhaps I haven't chosen the best way, but so far this has been easily managed and efficient. I think this makes perfect sense. For now, that tax, the tax on that account would be your tax, Stefan.
Yeah, so it's CGT max 18% if he's a high roller.
Right, but if you wait until he's 18, that can be his tax rate, and if he doesn't work yet, so if he's 18 and he's about to go study, it can be at his tax rate, which would be zero if he's not earning.
Well, it depends how much money it is. So what they do is, say Stefan gives him 100K, that's called his income for the year, notwithstanding donations, and let's park that aside. But you don't pay tax on the first whatever it is. So it basically becomes income. So there might be, if Stefan were to give him 1.5 million rand, he would pay 45%. But, you know, hey, worry about that if you've got 1.5 million.
Yeah,
rand.
That's not a bad going. But also you can manage it.
Yeah.
You can make sure that you do the most tax efficient thing possible, which I think is a great idea. The other thing is, because he's got these three accounts, you can always say to family members, if you want to contribute to the tax-free account, because now obviously if Stefan can't afford to max it out, I mean, I think very few people can afford to max it out and then have another one. So you can say to family members, for his birthday, please contribute to his tax-free savings account, which is awesome. Jennifer, this applies to you as well.
And just quick point on the 45%. I do know that the 45% is on the money over 1.5 million. Don't send me
emails.
Yeah,
please don't write us about that. We understand tax. Well, we understand this tax. We don't understand all tax.
We have an expert for the other tax.
Yes, thank you very much. Two experts, actually. Then the US dollar account. So we spoke about the end of the world in Zimbabwe and hyperinflation, all that stuff. He says, a few weeks ago, I logged a ticket with Easy Equities and I managed to get some clarity on the US account. The US account is real money sitting in a bank account in New York in your name.
Okay, so it's proper offshore.
It is actually money outside of the country.
The real McCoy.
He says Easy Equities does have an easy way to get the cash offshore. You put the cash in your regular account and then you can send the desired amount to your US account. The spreads are very wide though. Just explain what that means.
So spreads is buys and asks. So if you say to me right now, what's the rand at? I boogie to my live thing and I tell you it's 1370.78. And but you go to the bank, they're going to say, well, if you know, they'll have it 1350 versus 14. In other words, they go wide on either side. Now, truthfully, they transacted 1370, but that difference is
profit
for them.
Well, I mean, we don't...
Otherwise known as pillage, but yes.
I don't begrudge people that profit if they make it this easy to take it off, right?
Like, it's sweet of you. I begrudge them. I definitely begrudge them.
Okay, so Hendrik shared a spreadsheet with, get this, a retirement calculator, a calculator to move out whether it's... to work out whether it's worth it. Whoa. To move an RA. So you actually say how much you have in it, what your penalty will be, and then it spits out at the end, should you move it or not, yes or no. It is awesome because this is a question we get all of the time.
Frig, yeah.
So Hendrik made, he's an engineer, of course, so he made this spreadsheet and he's like, here, you should have it. And then he's got an RA tax contribution calculator as well. So I'm going to upload this. It's one document with three calculators in it. It is freaking amazing. Thank you so much for doing that, Hendrik. That's really, really, really generous. And then you guys can go work out should you move your RA from the expensive one to the cheap one. It'll tell you. And he also has his calculations in the spreadsheet, so you can check his numbers if you don't agree.
Cool.
His question is, what is the best way to manage payments and investments between spouses? So here's their setup. My wife and I each have our own accounts where our monthly debit orders go off. Then they've got a joint credit card that they both pay into. So they've got a positive balance on that credit card for their day-to-day expenses. And then they earn loyalty points. And they earn so many loyalty points that they can cover their monthly electricity payments with it using their credit card. That's freaking awesome.
Maybe they live in a cave.
He says, because we pay a set amount into this card, it serves as a budgeting tool. So they know that this is what they have to spend for our day-to-day expenses.
Oh, that's quite cunning.
We use our 22/7 to track all of our expenses and to determine how much we've got extra in a month, which they split between his wife's TFSA, because his is maxed out already, a retirement annuity, and paying extra on their home loan. He says that I figured that I'm guaranteed a saving of 10% interest on the home loan, and it serves as a good emergency fund as well. That's really great. Yes. I wonder, do you think that it's worth it to have one retirement annuity between two people? Is there any benefit to having? I'm not saying this is what they have. I can't really work out if it's.
So, as I understand, the retirement annuity would have to be in one person's name.
Right.
So that carries risk. If that person were to die or disappear or divorce or something like that, is there a benefit to it? Intuitively, I think no. I think there's definitely some risks to it, and I'm not sure that there's benefit. The one key point, of course, is that you can do 27.5% per person. So if it's going into mine, that's 27.5%. If I've got 30% I want to save, I can't put that extra. Well, I can, but I don't get the tax benefit of that extra two. Whereas if there's two of you, you each get 27.5%.
Do you know that you can actually carry that over to the next year?
Apparently you can. Yeah. I did not. You told me once before. So if anything, so it depends. If you're hitting the threshold then and you don't want to carry over, then there's probably a benefit to two. There's certainly some risks to having only one, and those risks are death, divorce, and all the horrible things.
But I mean, it's technically you would only pay one fee.
But you're going to... Well, it's the same. The fees are always percentages. You know, they're never minimums or anything like that. I mean, there might be some initiation fee. In fact, there will almost certainly be some initiation fee up front. But that's a one-off, modest-ish fee that you're going to save on.
Okay. Side note there. So he says when the home loan is paid off, they'll take that portion and put it into ETFs or shares or whatever. This seems like a great setup.
Well, he's asking what to do. Or is he telling us how best to do it?
I think a bit of both.
I think he's telling us how best to do it.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah.
This is a great setup.
Yeah.
So payments and investments between spouses. I think it's a really good idea to look at your household income, because obviously if you're two people who work, you've got two separate bank accounts. But I think it's a really good idea to think of your household income as shared income.
As one income.
I didn't think that it's necessary to say this, but I know so many people who are spouses who do not share their income, like who don't think about their income as a household income, which I find very odd, because you can be so much more efficient if you just pool the incomes and then decide what you're going to do. But people don't do that, apparently. Then lastly, Fred wants to know if there's a scenario where hyperinflation and exchange controls could lead to a South African-based fund that invests offshore not being able to trade or being shut down.
So exchange controls, yes. So we go back to the really, really bad old days of the 80s when we had strict exchange controls. And we had two currencies. We had a foreign, whatever they were. We had two exchange rates and shit like that. And back then, I mean, you couldn't own offshore assets. If you were going overseas, you could take out like a very small amount of money and they stamped it in your passport and et cetera, et cetera. Exchange controls are now effectively null and void to most South Africans. You can take 10 million per person per year. If you want to take more than 10 million offshore, man, like, hey.
Good for you. You have a lot of money.
You're balling. I need whiskey. Send to me. So to the average individual, effectively, there's no issue. And what we've had as a result is we've seen things, for example, the ETFs listing on the local market, which are not in any way impacting on our exchange controls and et cetera, sorry, on our 10 million limits and et cetera, et cetera. So there is a chance where our government, we wake up tomorrow and the government would say, so exchange controls are all back in place and blah, 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 and therefore the S&P 500 ETFs would have to shut down and pay us out and all of that. So, I mean, that is technically possible, yes.
What would happen to that Easy Equities offshore account of yours?
Well,
because that money is already in the States, right?
So what the government would, yes, so what the government, so your S&P 500 ETF is quite simple, right? Because there's a local register and they could go and force it to happen. They would go to CoreShares, Sydney, Satrix, and everyone else and force them to shut them down and pay it back. Your money that is literally offshore, what they do is they could go to Easy Equities and say, you know, we want to know who's got the money. In truth, you've been declaring it, right? Because you're a tax-paying citizen. And they then say to you, bring it back.
And then can you say, no, sir?
Sure. And then I don't know what happens. I mean, the point is they can't phone the bank in New York and force it. The bank in New York will say, like, sorry, who are you?
Yeah.
Minister of Finance of Africa. I don't think we give a f- about you. Yeah. But they will say to you, bring it back. And then it's up to you whether you listen or not. Yeah.
Man, that does not sound like a great time for anybody. That's it from us this week. Thank you for sticking with me in my calls. I appreciate that you listened all the way to the end. Remember, please, this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelife.com. My name is Chris Effenheden. Thank you so much to Simon Brown. We'll catch you next week.